ever leave me. I'd be sad and blue. Don't you ever leave me. I'm so in love with you. Birds in the sky would be sad and lonely if they knew that I lost my one and only. They'd be sad if you're bad to me. The leaves on the trees would be softly sighing if they heard from the breeze that you left me crying. They'd be sad. Don't be bad. I know you won't leave me, 'cause you told me so. I have no intention of letting you go. Just as long as you let me know, you won't be bad to me. So the birds in the sky won't be sad and lonely, 'cause they know that I got my one and only. They'll be glad you're not bad.
So that was the John Lennon demo of the song Bad to Me, written for Billy J. Kramer, one of Brian Epstein's finds and a talent that was signed to Brian for a while, who was the recipient of quite a few Lennon-McCartney tunes to launch his career.
Yeah, he had actually, I think, five of them initially that, you know, they all went at least top 10 in the UK.
Yes.
Two of them went to number one.
Yeah, he was quite a roll initially with this Lennon-McCartney material. Bad to Me being one, Do You Want to Know a Secret?, I Call Your Name, which the Beatles then recorded later on themselves, I'll Be on My Way, and I'll Keep You Satisfied.
Yep. And the theme of this show, this episode of Something About the Beatles, is
the songs that Lennon, McCartney, and Harrison gave away. Now, this is not cover tunes, because that'll be a whole other show, but these are the songs that were either surplus material or songs that they actually wrote to give to other artists.
Yeah, and there was an album, of course, back in, I think, what, the 80s, was it?
It was in the 70s, and they reissued it in 79.
Yeah,
and
the songs that Lennon McCartney gave away.
Yeah, so that if you're familiar with that album, then you pretty much have the idea what the show is going to be about.
Yeah.
I know that the second pressing of that, they added I'm the Greatest,
yes,
that John had written and given to Ringo. And, you know, not quite the same thing. I mean, that's something we could talk about if there's time of, you know, George giving the songs to Ronnie Spector, for instance. But we're going to concentrate on early stuff, 63, 64, as well as have a special guest, Billy J. Kramer himself.
Yep, he'll be joining us a bit later on. I think we'll also be delving into some of the later things, such as, you know, Paul in 68, Step Inside Love,
yes,
Cilla Black,
and then
in
Come and Get It,
Come and Get It,
Mary, yep, Hopkin, Goodbye. Yeah,
yep,
we'll work our way there.
Yep.
I mean, Paul, of course, being the most prolific of crafting material for other artists.
Yeah.
But pretty early on, you know, as we now know, reading the Mark Lewisohn book, Tune In, how the Beatles' deal with EMI was in large parts, it came about by the music publishing for some of those songs they recorded at the Decca audition.
Yeah.
And, you know, this was Lennon McCartney original material. I think, what was it, three songs they recorded at the Decca audition in January of 62 that,
yeah,
they'd written, Like Dreamers Do, Love of the Loved, and Hello Little Girl.
Yeah, and what's interesting about that is, you know, for a long time until Mark Lewisohn's book came out, it was really sort of, you know, the general sort of consensus was that Brian Epstein was the one who basically had pushed the Beatles to show a broad range of, you know, material.
Yeah,
most
all that
of it,
novelty stuff.
Novelty stuff like, you know, Three Called Cats or,
yes,
Sheik of Araby.
Right.
And, you know, that he was the one who was like curtailing the inclusion of their own songs.
Right.
And it's actually the opposite. It was the other way around.
Yes.
You know, there are, we all heard the stories of Lennon McCartney writing very early on, you know, like sort of 59 into 1960.
Yeah.
But then there's like, really what comes out in Mark's book is, I think, is a period of about a couple of years
where they're really not writing at all. No.
And they're,
right,
just a covers band.
And there was that supposed 100 songs that they'd written, 100 Lennon McCartney originals,
right,
of which, you know, you can count on one hand the number that actually ended up surfacing.
Right.
And there were little snatches of them they played, like, during the Let It Be sessions that ended up not being anything. But what is interesting is that of those songs that they recorded at the Decca auditions, which got some hearings, even when they weren't performing them on stage, they were actually recorded by other people.
Yeah, and it was only around, I think, 1962 that, with Brian's encouragement, they really started writing again, you know, that they were getting this recording contract.
Well, there was that telegram he sent them when they were in Germany.
Yeah.
Please rehearse new material.
Yes.
Yes. So, that was kind of what got the ball rolling again.
But what's fantastic is that they just suddenly go gangbusters.
You know,
their songwriting goes berserk. And while some of the songs that they gave away, you can kind of see that maybe they were a bit too commercial for what the Beatles wanted to do, there are others that are really, frankly, quite puzzling, you know, just great songs that were big hits for other artists.
Yeah, and it's interesting that of the songs that later years Beatles takes with surface of, you know, the Decca recordings were not, you know, ever made public for years and years after, except on bootlegs during the 70s. So we didn't get to hear John Lennon singing Hello Little Girl or Paul singing Love of the Loved back in the 60s. And there were the things that surfaced through the anthology, like I'll Be On My Way. And
well,
that
I'll Be On My Way is from the BBC sessions.
So yes. Right. Okay. So that was public in the 60s.
Yeah, that was 94 was officially released.
Right. But not until the bootleg era that stuff starts surfacing. So, you know, if you caught it on radio in 63, then that was the time you heard the Beatles play it and never again, because later on it was recorded by Billy J. Kramer, and that would have been the familiar version.
And then that's a song that, you know, I think John in the Playboy interview in 1980, when they're going through his material, he's going through it with David Sheff interviewing him.
Yeah.
And I think when Sheff says, you know, I'll be on my way, he goes something like, the sun has faded away, tra la 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 la, can't you tell? It's Paul.
Yeah. You know? I can't remember, it wasn't that song, it was another one. He goes, that's Paul's crap, not my crap, or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's how they were so unbelievably prolific once those gates had been opened, that they were just, you know, they had more material really than they could use.
And it's not as if they weren't recording much. I mean, they were putting out two albums a year.
Yeah, 14 songs per, many singles.
You know, if we look at 68 and 69, really with the White Album being a double album, you've got the equivalent of four albums, you know, official sort of studio albums in 69, right? You know, Let It Be and Abbey Road.
Yes.
And yet you've still got, as I said before, Paul doing all this material, you know, for Badfinger, Cilla Black.
Yeah.
You know, Mary
and it's
Hopkins.
All over the map. A Black Dyke Mills band.
Unbelievable.
Yes.
You know, the wealth of material and really good material.
Yeah.
So that's what we're going to be listening to in this show.
Yeah, there's all kinds of stuff. And circling back to the Decca audition tapes and Hello Little Girl, I became familiar with it in the 70s when that stuff started getting bootlegged. There were the Decagon singles put out by Joe Pope.
Yeah.
And it was so revelatory and amazing to hear these recordings that, you know, you'd been reading about for years, as, you know, the Beatles did this audition for Decca Records. They got turned down. They weren't, you know, at their peak performing that day. And, you know, you just want to know what the stuff sounded like. And then when it eventually did surface, you're thinking, well, it's not that bad. You know, these are some pretty decent original songs. And certainly they caught the ears of the music publishers at the time, got them their deal steered to Parlophone. And starting with Hello Little Girl. Now, we know that, you know, the hit version that came out was by the Foremost.
Yeah.
And what I didn't know until I was researching the show was that Jerry and the Pacemakers did a version of it, too.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Well, let's hear it. It's pretty good, actually. So let's hear the three versions that we have, starting with the Beatles' Decca audition in 62, then the hit version by the Foremost, which actually went to number 9 in 1963, and then
the U.K.
In the U.K., yeah. Yeah, they couldn't get arrested here. And then the Jerry the Pacemakers version, which I'd never heard of. I don't even know if it was released, quite frankly.
Hello, little girl. Hello, little girl. Hello, little girl. When I see you every day, I say, hello, little girl. When you're passing on your way, I say, hello, little girl. When I see you passing by, I cry, hello, little girl. When I try to catch your eye, I cry, hello, little girl.
Hello, I send you flowers, but you don't care. You never seem to see me standing there. I often wonder what you're thinking of. I hope it's me, love, love, love. So I hope there'll come a day when you say, you're my little girl.
I say, oh, hello, little girl. When you're passing on your way, I say, oh, hello, little girl. You
It's not the first time it's happened to me. It's been a long, lonely time. And it's so funny to see that I'm about to lose my mind, my mind. So I hope there'll come a day when you'll say, uh-huh, you're my little girl.
So that was Hello Little Girl, which is one of the first songs that John ever wrote.
Yes.
Yeah. And next we're going to listen to Love of the Loved, which, again, the Beatles recorded for the Decca audition. It's a Paul song. Not one of my favorites, personally, but...
Nice performance.
I way prefer their performance to the Cilla Black version, which I think was her first single.
Yes. And who's Cilla Black?
Cilla Black. Priscilla White.
Yes.
Who I think Bill Harry says that he
renamed her.
That, yeah. Cilla Black or inadvertently, yeah.
He knew it was a color.
Yeah, exactly. I think, hasn't she claimed that it was John who...
She claims a lot of stuff through the years.
Yeah.
But
and, you know, the story is that she was a hat check girl at the Cavern.
Yes.
And she would get up on stage and she had this sort of raw, nasally voice with the bright red hair.
Yes.
And the Beatles championed her cause and
yes.
She got signed by Brian.
She sang with the Big Three, I believe, didn't she?
I'm not sure about that.
Yeah. I mean, she was just considered the in-house chick singer at the Cavern.
Right.
And really big voice.
Yeah. So anyway, and she's still a big sort of celebrity in Britain today.
Yes.
But this is her version of Love of the Loved, which is, you know, I think 1963.
Yeah, 63. It was her first single. It was not a hit. It was not a big hit.
And it didn't deserve to be.
It didn't deserve to be. But here it is, and we'll hear coming out of it the Beatle version so you can have an A-B comparison.
Each time I look into your eyes, I see that there, there heaven lies. And as I look, I see the love of the love. Someday they'll see that from the start, my place has been deep in your heart. And in your heart, I see the love of the love. I'll see it in the way that you look at me and say, you love me. So let it rain, what do I care? Deep in your heart, I'll still be there. And when I'm there, I see the love of the love. I see the love of the love.
So that was Swingin' Cilla and the Beatles covering the same song. It was Burt Bacharach, who later on was involved in her recording of Alfie in 65 or 66, I think.
66.
Yeah, yeah, when George Martin produced that. And he said at the time that he thought her voice was strident and he preferred Dionne Warwick's version of Alfie much to Cilla's. But Cilla had quite the career, actually. And it was the second Lennon-McCartney song that she recorded, It's For You, that actually... showed her to better effect than the original one.
It's also a better song.
It is a better song. And once again, a song that was crafted, I think, with her in mind.
Yeah.
That the Beatles never, there's no version of them doing it at all. And,
it's actually, I think lyrically and musically, it's quite an interesting structure. The way that the lines sort of, you know, come together and they build.
Yeah, it's a bit it's more sophisticated for sure. Mm. And what we have here is her version of it introduced by John Lennon.
Hello, this is John Lennon of the Beatles. We'd like to play you a song now that Paul and I have just written, especially for Cilla Black. Beautiful girl, a beautiful singer. Hope you like it. Here it is. It's called It's For You.
I'd say someday I'm bound to give my heart away when I do. It's for you. Don't of me. Then I look at you and love comes, love shows. I give my heart and no one knows that I do. It's for you. It's for you. They said that love was a lie. Told me that I should never try to find somebody who'd be kind, kind to only me. So I just tell them the right. Who wants a fight? Tell them I quite agree. Nobody'd love me. Then I look at you and love comes, love shows.
That John Lennon intro was from a promotional record, I believe, put out by Capitol, trying to break her in America, which never really happened. I think the closest she came was You're My World.
Yeah, that was a big hit in Britain.
Yeah, that was a big hit everywhere. And but she didn't really have much of a career here, as contrasted with Britain. The flip side of that promotional record actually has Paul introducing Peter and Gordon, I Don't Ever Want to See You Again. Which okay. We'll move on to them in a second, as far as their being recipients of spare Beatle material.
Yeah.
But we've covered Scylla. What was the other song? Oh, yes. Like Dreamers Do.
Yes.
Another song from the Decca auditions that got shopped out to a group called the Applejacks.
And that's actually a pretty decent version.
It's very good, actually, yeah. Yeah. Do you know much about the Applejacks?
Not a whole lot.
So the Applejacks were a Decca band from Birmingham. They were not part of the Brian
Birmingham.
Epstein.
God, I tell you, folks, he'll get it right one day.
Yeah, Birmingham. Well, we've got one in Alabama.
No, not hum. Birmingham, like Buckingham.
Yeah, whatever. Beat them. So they were this band. They were not connected with Brian per se, but they had a hit in early 64 called Tell Me When. Are you familiar with it?
Tell me when. Da, 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 da.
Okay. Went to number 7. We'll phone you. They didn't do anything in America, but it was Paul that encountered them apparently when they were sharing a bill or something like that, saying, hey, could you guys use a follow-up? And right. He pitches them Like Dreamers Do.
Yeah.
And that ended up being their second single. It went to number 20. It didn't do as good as its predecessor, but their recording is actually really good.
And you know that was the inspiration for them, the Beatles naming their company Apple, don't you?
The Applejacks?
Yeah.
I thought it was Magritte.
Yeah, I was just joking.
Okay. We'll phone you.
I was trying to see if he was going to BS us there and said, right. Yeah, you knew.
Right. Damn. Now, what I do know about these guys before they faded away was they did record a version of Ray Davies' I Go to Sleep, later on recorded by the Pretenders.
Now that I didn't know.
Yeah. Anyway, so here we go.
I saw a girl in my dreams, and so it seems that I will love her. Oh, you are that girl in my dreams, and so it seems.
just one dream ago.
So that was the Applejacks with Like Dreamers Do, made it to number 20, and they kind of faded away after that.
But way bigger than that were Peter and Gordon.
Peter and Gordon.
Peter Asher and Gordon Waller. Peter Asher, the brother of Jane Asher, who was Paul's girlfriend at the time.
Yes.
And Paul was staying at the Asher's house on Wimpole Street in London.
Yeah, as of 63, because they had written I Want to Hold Your Hand and other songs in the piano on the piano in their basement.
That's correct, yeah.
Yes. So here was a song that was not custom crafted for Peter and Gordon, but it was one that Paul had written, and the story they were fond of telling was that John and George could never get past the first line, "Please lock me away."
Yeah, and I don't quite get that story, to be honest, because... Okay, so you can't get past the first line. Well, rewrite the first line. That was never a big deal for the Beatles.
Right.
So, you know, there must be more to it than that. If they really loved that song, they would have obviously just given it a different line. I mean,
Paul was just digging his heels and liked the line.
Scrambled eggs turned into yesterday. So,
yes.
You know.
The movement you need is on your shoulder.
Right.
Stayed.
Right, exactly. So there must be more to it. I don't quite understand it because in that era of sort of 63, early 64... It was a really good song, and I think it could have suited their canon of work.
It could have worked. It was definitely more sophisticated than some of the stuff they were doing at the time. But, you know, apparently Peter Asher just snatched it up. He was like, I'll take that. And what is interesting is, you know, best we can tell now, because Peter himself, he does this presentation. He's done it at the Fest. He's done it in L.A. It's sort of like his musical journey through the 60s, this sort of multimedia thing where he does the actual duets with Peter or with Gordon Waller on film, but he traces his career and the people he knew and all that sort of thing. Anyway,
which we should say, you know, he worked for Apple.
Yeah, he worked for Apple, brought in James Taylor,
saw
the writing on the wall, took him to Warner Brothers, where they had a great career, and later on he produced the hits for Linda Ronstadt in the
70s. Absolutely.
So great, great career out of that guy. Anyway, so their career as a chart act was launched with A World Without Love in 1964. It was the first non-Beatles British act to have a number one hit in America, which is pretty huge. So that was quite the favor.
Yeah.
But what is interesting is that, you know, he's been revisiting his past and digging in, you know, doing the research for the show he's doing. He found it's about a 30-second demo of Paul demonstrating World Without Love, such as it is.
Yeah, it's not really like a full demo. He's just doing like a verse.
Yeah.
And I think at the end you can hear him say something along the lines of, "That's how it goes."
Yes, it's exactly. Let's listen to it.
Away and don't allow the day here inside where I hide. If my loneliness, I don't care what you say, I won't stay in a world without love.
Birds sing out of tune and rain clouds hide the moon. I'm okay. Here I'll stay with my loneliness. I don't care what they say, I won't stay in a world without love. So I wait, and in a while I will see my true love smile. She may come, I know not when. When she does, I lose. So baby, until then, lock me away and don't allow the day here inside where I hide with my loneliness. I don't care what they say, I won't stay in a world without love. I don't care what they say, I won't stay in a world without love.
Okay, so that was the studio recording of World Without Love by Peter and Gordon, which, as we mentioned, went to number one, which was just amazing. It was a transatlantic number one single in late spring, early summer of 1964.
I mean, you know, not that long, I take it, after, you know, the Beatles were numbers 1 to 5 in the U.S.
Yes,
charts.
Yes, right. That, there was that, that was in April.
Yeah.
And so this was a little later on from that. But Paul, you know, inspired by their success, then wrote a song for them, Nobody I Know.
And nobody knew it.
No, it actually did pretty well. Went to number 10 in Britain, number 12 here. Not bad.
Yeah.
It was the follow-up to that that kind of died on the vine. I Don't Want to See You Again.
Yeah, I don't think I've even heard that.
No, but it was after that that they sort of detached, disengaged from the Lennon McCartney stuff for a while.
Right.
They did I Go to Pieces by Del Shannon, terrific song.
Yeah.
They did Buddy Holly's True Love Ways.
Absolutely,
that was another hit there.
Well, sort of specter-ish production, like completely overblown production on that one.
Yeah, but it's a good track.
Yeah.
It's a good song.
Yeah.
It wasn't until 1966 that McCartney then pitched them another song.
Yeah, called Woman. And to test the market, which I think was great, actually. You know, it was done under the pseudonym of Bernard, or as you say here, Bernard.
Yeah.
But in England, it would be Bernard Webb.
Right, with this whole backstory that he was a French student or something that pitched the song to Peter Gordon, who just snatched it up. And funnily enough, in America, the Capitol pressings credited it to A. Smith. Were you aware of that?
Oh, really? No, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Bernard Webb in the UK, and it actually worked. I mean, I don't know how it did in the UK. It was a US top 10 hit, though, wasn't it?
It came out in the spring of 1966. It did number 14 here. It did top 30 in Britain. It was like 28.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay.
But it was still, it's still one of their best known recordings. And, you know, let's hear it. It's a great song.
Woman, do you love me? Woman, if you need me, then woman, do you love me? Woman, if you need me, then believe me, I need you to be my woman. And should you ask me how I'm doing, what shall I say? Things are okay, well I know that they're not, and I still may have lost. Woman, do you love me? Woman, if you need me, then believe me, I need you to be my woman. I've got plenty of time,
I've got plenty of time
just to get through it. Once again you'll be mine,
once again you'll be mine.
I still think we can do it, and you know how much I love you. Woman, don't forsake me. Woman, if you take me, then believe me, I'll take you to be my woman.
So that was one of the last hits Peter and Gordon had in America, Woman. I think they followed up with Lady Godiva. I'm not sure what came after that. But that pretty much, you know, they were sort of winding down their career as a duo. And Peter then ended up working at Apple starting in 68. But, you know, it's a great song. And, you know, word did come out at some point that it was Paul McCartney that wrote it while it was out.
But did that impact the sales, though? You know,
hard to tell.
Yeah.
I mean, it's certainly on its own merits. And he listened to the song. You know, it's a great McCartney melody, you know, decent enough lyric, one that you cannot imagine the Beatles recording.
Right. No, I agree.
Certainly not in 66.
Right. Oh, no way.
Yeah, no way.
No way. Yeah.
But it shows Paul's gift for being able to craft, you know, standard quality material that anybody else can turn into a hit.
Yeah.
And did.
Yeah.
And it's a worthy composition.
Yes.
As contrasted to some of the earlier stuff they were pitching around to people, One and One is Two.
Yeah, which I think Billy J. Kramer turned that one down. We'll ask him about that.
Yeah, we'll ask him about that. But there was a version that charted by a group called The Strangers in May 1964. I don't know a thing about them other than we're British. Again, they weren't a Brian Epstein Liverpool act that was in his stable. Hmm. But it's not a bad recording of a song that's a piece of nothing, basically.
Really, yeah. I mean, you know, the lyrics are absolutely pathetic.
Yeah, let's hear a bit of that.
One and one is two, what am I to do now that I'm in love with you? I'm hoping every day I'm gonna hear you say, you really make my wish come true. Can't you see when I'm holding you near, all the things I do? Show my love and I'm making it clear, one and one is two.
So another one dating from that time that I remember my first exposure was there was a paperback version of the Beatles lyrics that was around in the 70s, and they were throwing everything in there.
Yes.
And, you know, in my naivete at the time, I was looking for Beatle recordings of a song called Tip of My Tongue and One is Two and From a Window, not knowing, because it doesn't tell you in the book that these were shopped around.
Right.
But Tip of My Tongue was one that ended up being recorded by a guy named Tommy Quickley.
Another Epstein signing and probably his biggest flop.
It was, right, in terms of Brian's stable of artists, for sure.
Yeah.
The guy's original name was Tommy Quigley.
Yeah.
And why they changed it to Quickly, it's not like a flattering thing to associate somebody
Dirk
with.
Dirk McQuickly.
Right, yeah, exactly. Liverpudlian, and he was a guy that would sing with the Remo Four, who, of course, we know, you know, had sort of that, they were in the Beatles peer group, ended up working with George on the Wonderwall soundtrack as they were disintegrating. But their biggest hit, or Tommy's, was Tip of My Tongue. It was not really a hit at all, but it got him in the charts, and he faded away really quickly.
Yeah.
He got dropped by his label like the following year. So that recording was from 63. So an example of, you know, while the Beatles are a big hit-making act in Britain in 63, they're just huge, and of course people are just lining up to record anything they've got written by John and Paul, it didn't always translate into hits.
No. Well, no, I know that the in Britain in 63, I think the Kestrels recorded There's a Place.
Oh, is that right?
Yep. And then there was also the, what was the song they wrote for Helen Shapiro?
Misery.
There you go. Yeah.
But Kenny Lynch ended up recording that.
Exactly.
I couldn't tell you if he had a hit right off the top of my head, but right. You know, he ended up being on the cover of Band on the Run years later.
That's right. Yeah,
10
he
years
was
later.
A regular in Britain for many years on TV, sort of comedian.
Okay. So kind of a known quantity.
Yeah.
Can't say that song really launched his career, but
no.
So what else is there? Oh, P.J. Proby.
Oh, P.J. Proby. There's a story.
Yes. He's a guy from Texas, an American.
Who basically had done recordings for Elvis, like basically, you know, doing the demo vocals.
Back in the 60s?
Yeah, back in the 60s.
Okay.
Yeah. So we're talking like, you know, 63, something like that, before he goes to Britain.
Mm-hmm.
He's doing stuff for Elvis.
Mm.
Years later, he would appear in a stage show after Elvis died in the late 70s. There was an Elvis stage show in Britain. And in London, and there were three Elvises. There was like young Elvis, middle Elvis, who I remember was played by Shaking Stevens,
mm-hmm.
who became, you know, a big hit as a result of that show, a Welsh artist, had all the moves. And then P.J. Proby was like jumpsuit Elvis.
The fat Elvis.
Yeah, the fatter Elvis.
Okay.
And, you know, he screwed that one up for himself as well. He was like doing great. It was a sold out show, but he kept changing his own lines every night until they got fed up, must have warned him and gave him the elbow.
So he was always a bit of a handful, wasn't he?
Always, yeah, more than a bit of a handful, yeah. And back in 65, I think it was.
He was actually on a roll. He actually had some hit records. What was it, Hold On? Hold Me? What was
Hold
it?
Me, yeah.
Yeah.
Hold Me was a big hit in Britain. And
so he's touring, like with Cilla Black and people like that doing theater tours.
Yeah.
And what ended up happening with him?
Well, he's wearing, I think they were like satin pants, or I don't know if they were leather pants, you know, these sort of tight
pants. They looked like they were painted on?
Yeah, kind of. And he did a gig where the pants, you know, he did one of his moves, like, you know, a sort of leg split or something,
uh-huh.
and it split the pants from his crotch to his knee.
Yes.
And he
was
got
he going commando?
He got a warning, is what he got. He got a warning from the cops and or the local authorities. Don't do that again. And it was all a big mistake. You know, he didn't intend it. And of course, two or three nights later, he went and did it again.
Nice.
And at that point, I think he was like literally, you know,
drummed out of the business.
Yeah, he was drummed out of the business. His work permit in Britain was cancelled. I don't think he could get back there for a couple of years.
Wow.
So he totally messed up. But
he had that record, I Apologize, which actually predated all this nonsense, didn't it?
Yeah, really.
I think it was in the charts. So you would think in retrospect that was him trying to win his career back. But
anyway, so that's a little bit of, you know, sort of information.
A little backstory there.
Yeah, about PJ.
And why are we concerned about him?
Well, because he did cover
That Means a Lot.
Absolutely.
Now, that was a song that the Beatles did a couple attempts at during the Help sessions in 65. So it was a song that, you know, compositionally, it's not a bad song. And I'm thinking, you know, the story, the conventional wisdom on that is that they couldn't get a handle on it, recording it in the studio. They did an attempt in February, and I think they returned to it in March or April of 65. They just couldn't get a nailed version of it down that would have fit with everything else they were doing.
It's also just not a compelling song.
No, it's not great. It's kind of dirge-like.
Yeah.
You know, and then Proby ended up taking the song and doing this sort of dramatic reading of it.
Which is what he did with everything.
Yeah, okay. So we'll play a bit of that and you get the picture. But, you know, he, you know, was one of these artists that, again, was accorded a Lennon-McCartney song at the height of their career, and it didn't really do much for him, but that was more due to his own behavior than the qualities of the recording.
Right. So what we'll do is we'll play the Beatles version, and then Tom, our producer, will do one of his ingenious crossfades into the PJ.
Here you go.
It's just a test. 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3. A friend says that your love don't mean a lot, but you know that your love is all you've got. At times things are so fine, and at times they're not. But when she says she loves you,
says that your love won't mean a lot, and you knew that your love is all you've got. At times things are so fine, and at times they're not. But when she says she loves you, that means a lot. Love can be a suicide. Come to see, you can't hide what you feel when it's real.
Okay, so what we've basically omitted so far is a whole glut of songs that we mentioned before, you know, that were recorded by Billy J. Kramer to great success. And we've got him now joining us on the line from New York.
Yes.
Okay.
From New York.
Okay, and the show is about the songs that the Beatles gave away. That's been the main theme.
Right.
But I want to just start off, just make sure we got our facts right here. William Ashton, the name Kramer came from a phone directory, and the J was a suggestion of John Lennon's?
That's right.
How did that happen?
I was about to bring out my first record, which is Do You Want to Know a Secret? When Brian gave me a call and said, can you come in the office? And I went into his office, and was in Liverpool, and John Lennon was sat there, and he said, John has a suggestion for you. And I said, what is it? And he said, John said, why don't you call yourself Billy J. Kramer? It needs rounding off. It's too, you know, it needs something that people catch on to easily.
Yeah. Great
and
idea.
And I said, thank you, that's a great idea.
Yeah. So Do You Want to Know a Secret, how did that actually come about? I mean, were you searching around for, you know, material for your first single?
Brian gave me one of them spools, these, you know, tape spools.
Yeah.
And said, you know, I want you to learn this when we're going to go for a record deal. And it was John Lennon singing Do You Want to Know a Secret on an acoustic guitar.
Wow.
So we learned it and we arranged it, and we went off to Hamburg and we did it there, and when we came back we went in and recorded it with George Martin.
You'll never know how much I really love you. You'll never know how much I really care. Listen, do you want to know a secret? Promise not to tell. Whoa, 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 closer. Let me whisper in your ear. Say the words I love to hear. I'm in love with you.
That was backed by I'll Be On My Way, which if I'm right, I think it was considered to be the first song that Lennon McCartney actually gave away.
Sure, I think so, yes.
Do you still have that demo of Do You Want to Know a Secret?
No, I wish I did.
So do we.
That's about the toilet flush.
You know, because, I mean, I'll be honest with you, back then it's like, we never thought about such things, you know, and, lyrics would be lying on the studio and tapes and things where I'd just, at the end of the session, I'd walk off and not even think about it, you know.
Yeah.
In fact, I actually gave the acetate of Do You Want to Know a Secret to the woman at the information desk at the airport when I was going back to Liverpool, you know.
Wow.
You know.
Wow. My partner, my co-host, Robert Rodriguez, has got a question.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Hi, Billy. The legend is that John Lennon demo tape of Do You Want to Know a Secret ends with a toilet flushing. Can you confirm that?
Yes, that's true.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So then you recorded I'll Call Your Name.
No, I didn't. I recorded Bad to Me.
Yeah. Oh, Bad to Me, that's right, which was written for you specifically by John, wasn't it, while he was on holidays in Spain with Brian?
I don't know I don't know about that, but I just know it was he first told me about it when I was on tour with him in Bournemouth. He said, it was my 20th birthday, and he said, I've got a song for you, you know, and the next time you have the road, I'll come and I'll play it for you.
What's interesting to me is that when you recorded it in June of 63, Paul was at that session, and it's mainly a John song, but Paul was there.
No, he wasn't.
I wasn't. Okay. Great. So were any of them present for it?
He turned up and he played. Funny enough, people always ask me about the demo.
Yeah.
What was the demo like? And I said, there was no demo. He sat and played it actually on the piano.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said, I want to run a song by you. Tell me what you think of this one. And he played, I Want to Hold Your Hand. And I said, can I have that? And he said, no. Doing that ourselves, you know.
And, I mean, would they basically give directives, you know, beyond the demo, which obviously lays it out for you, but in terms of how it had to be recorded, or were you given the artistic freedom to take it your own way?
We were given the freedom. I mean, you know, I tell people that, you know, all of the songs apart from Do You Want to Know a Secret, we learnt them on the day we recorded them. We never heard them before.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, Bad to Me, it was on the day. I Call Your Name, it was the same day as Bad to Me.
Yes.
I'll Keep You Satisfied, this is, you know, demo from a window, yeah. You know.
Yeah, well, Bad to Me, that went to number one.
Right.
Yeah, and I think in the US the following year it was top 10.
Right. Well, I'll be honest with you, what happened was when we recorded Bad to Me, it wasn't coming together, and we went on to I Call Your Name, which is the B-side in England.
Yeah.
And I wanted to find the B-side for I Call Your Name and release that, you know, but George Martin said no. Hmm. You know.
Yeah.
And at that time I wasn't into getting into a confrontation about it, you know.
Right, right.
I call your name, but you're not there. Why am I to blame for being unfair? Oh, I can't sleep at night since you've been.
I'm in Love. You recorded that in October of 63, but it ended up being recorded by the Foremost. What's the story there?
I was at the end of a session, and John and Paul came in and said, "You got to do this song." And you know, we just got two tracks very roughly, and we only had 20 minutes left, and we just didn't go back to it. And we left it a long time, and obviously they passed it on to the Foremost because I didn't do it. EMI later put out the track that we had done, you know.
Yes.
Because John and I were benching on it, and I thought that was rather cheap of them to do that anyway.
Yeah.
What was it that time?
You're my kind of girl.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
One, two, three, four.
I'm in love.
Hey!
Adam Faith, you fool!
I can't get it, John.
I give you full permission to come to the Beatles session on Thursday and shout at John whenever you like.
32.
Initial trip to America in late 63 with Brian.
Right.
How did that, you know, in terms of what you were seeing and the reaction you were getting at that time,
right,
how did that contrast with how it was when you went back to America the following year?
Firstly, you know, nothing at all British was happening, and Brian would invite people to the Waldorf Astoria to his suite, and I would be there, and I was trying to be a salesman as well, and you know, talk about the Beatles and show the people the photographs and the articles and the newspapers, such as when they were dressed as policemen and things like that, and I didn't know what they really thought. You know, they've never heard of them. I said, well, you will do, you know.
Yes.
And you know, things like, I remember Brian and I went out one night, and like Rolf Harris was having a big hit at the time with the Timey Kangaroo Down Sport. And,
yeah.
You know, it was, nothing really Brit-wise was happening, and, it was amazing to go back a year later, and everybody was like women screaming and saying, can you just stand and talk to me?
Yeah.
And stuff like that, you know, it all went crazy, you know.
Mm. What was that experience like? Just describe that. I mean, we've heard, you know, others describe, but I mean, being in the eye of the hurricane like that in 64 and 65, you know, performing in the US and, you know, people just going absolutely nuts.
Well, you know, I mean, like to start with, this one thing, I mean, like the EMI a couple of years ago put out a box set, you know, on that tour, the first tour I did, they wanted to do like a live album, but the response from the crowd was so intense that, you know, the equipment we had at the time just couldn't handle it, and they ended up just scrapping the whole thing. But, you know, we're having today's technology, they put some of it together in this box set, you know. It was very different, you know, I mean, instead of arriving at a theater and finding your way through a crowd, you drove into a big auditorium and just got off a bus, and, you know, that was the difference.
Yeah. Really, yeah. I mean, that changed within a decade, but it was. It was like a different world.
Yes, it was, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, people just went crazy. It was the same in England, you know. But every night was like the poll winner's poll, like the enemy poll winner's poll in London, you know.
Yes. Yeah.
Big and millions of people, you know.
Yeah. Now, before you had another UK number one with Little Children in March of 64,
right.
You turned down One and One is Two.
Right.
Yeah, which I'm not surprised. Not their finest composition.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, was that it? I mean, basically it was offered to you and you just said, like, no, or, I mean...
No, they offered... there was two other songs, but I can't... I really honestly can't remember what they were.
Right.
But I wasn't happy with any of them, you know.
Right. Right.
The other songs have been so great, and I was like, you know, I couldn't understand, you know.
Yes.
There was a total drop in the quality, which just wasn't like them, you know.
Yeah, so then you did do From a Window.
Right.
Which, now, was that written for you?
I presume so, yeah.
Yeah.
Play yesterday night. I saw a light shine from a window, and as I looked again, your face came into sight. I couldn't walk on until you'd gone from your window. I had to make you mine. I knew you were the one. Oh, I would be glad just to have a love like that. Oh, I would be true, and I'd live my life for you. So, meet me tonight, just where the light shines from a window. And as I take your hand, say that you be mine tonight. Tonight, just where the light shines from a window, and as I take your hand, say that you be mine tonight.
Well, Billy, thank you very much for being on the show. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Okay, take care.
You take care. Thank you very much.
Bye now.
Bye.
To get back to the discussion of Beatles pitching material to other artists, by late 65, 66, well, apart from Woman, they pretty much stopped doing that because now they're segueing into their career as studio artists.
And they're just not writing the kind of material that, you know, they were doing before, this commercial pop material.
Although,
so, where they'd have a dearth of, you know, yes, basically way too much of it, I should say. And
well, they're putting everything they got into their own career. That said, you still have Paul McCartney, who is always recognizing how his material is transferable to other artists. So you've got, it was actually...
Well, especially in the wake of Yesterday. And Yesterday, I think, still holds, you know, the Guinness World Record for the most covered song of all time.
But it was early 66 that Michelle ended up being the hit on both sides of the Atlantic. In America, it was David and Jonathan who covered it because the Beatles didn't put it out as a single
themselves. Which is, you know, it's funny because David and Jonathan are British artists.
Yes.
But yet it was a different British outfit, the Overlanders, who had the hit in Britain with it.
Yeah, that's a rustic-sounding name. And what did they sound like?
Folky.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, kind of like the Springfields or something? Well, come 1960...
That's your only idea of folk, is it?
British folk, yeah. Such as it is.
Dylan or, you know...
No, British folk.
Donovan. Oh,
they're different folks
Donovan.
There.
Donovan?
Yeah. Well,
thank you.
Hurdy-gurdy, man.
Yeah. Don't need your facetiousness over there, Rodriguez.
66, Revolver album. Here, There, and Everywhere. That's like a standard if ever was.
Yeah.
And who records it but the Foremost?
Right.
Yeah, and not that it was a big hit or anything, but you then have Paul with Got to Get You Into My Life producing the session for Cliff Bennett and the Rabble Rouser. What are they? Rabble Rouser.
You can just start it with, and then you've got Paul.
And then you've got Paul producing more or less sanctioned official cover of a non-single at the time Revolver track, Got to Get You Into My Life. He produced it for Cliff Bennett and the Rebel Rousers.
That's it?
Yeah, not Rabble Rousers.
No, Rebel.
Yeah. Yeah, and I believe it was a hit. Wasn't it a hit?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah,
it was.
Okay. And then it ended up being a hit 10 years later for the Beatles themselves. Mm. But, you know, you're going into 1967. You know, they're working on being this studio band, putting everything they've got into their own material, their own craftsmanship, and they're not really pitching the songs around so much. However,
They're not writing as many songs, basically, at that point.
No, they're not. Right. And when they do, you know, it's they read something in the Daily Mail and end up writing She's Leaving Home or something like that.
Yeah.
Chris Barber, summer of 1967, is the recipient of a Paul McCartney composition.
Yeah, noted jazz musician in Britain.
The guy who gave us Lonnie Donegan.
That's it.
Which gave us Skiffle, which gave us the Beatles.
Yeah.
So he'd been a jazz guy, and Lonnie Donegan was a member of his band, who sort of spun off into the whole Skiffle thing, and that became a thing. You know, all these teenage kids in Britain pick up instruments, the Beatles become part of that. And
yeah.
So now we're coming full circle. The Summer of Love, 1967, Paul McCartney records a session producing Chris Barber, a song called Catcall.
Right, and we shouldn't forget also that, you know, around that time, just before that, Paul had, you know, composed and basically, I think, conducted in the, you know, the score for The Family Way, the
yes,
movie.
Right, late 66,
yeah.
While John was in Spain shooting How I Won the War.
Right.
So here we are, The Summer of Love, and he records this, how would you describe this music? Sort of a throwback.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of surprising in 67, isn't
right.
it?
Right. Well, he had that side to him, though. You know, yeah. The same year he's recording When I'm 64, and he's got Your Mother Should Know, and all that sort of thing. Yeah. So he's finding an outlet for that side of him that certainly wouldn't have fit with the Beatles.
The schlock side.
The schlock side. But where does he go back to? A composition that the Beatles were performing on stage in the early 60s as Cats Walk.
Yes.
And there's a recording, which we'll hear in a second, of them doing it at the Cavern.
That's right, rehearsing it at the Cavern. Yeah.
And this, it again, shows that, you know, the Beatles had such a breadth to their what their repertoire was. They were performing instrumentals, they were performing show tunes, they were performing all kinds of stuff that had nothing to do with rock and roll.
Well, which we would get to see in 68 on the White Album.
Absolutely.
You've got,
sort
you
of
know,
setting the table for that, isn't it?
Yeah, really, yeah.
So here you are, they're coming full circle, doing a song back 5 years, you know, a lifetime ago in their career, and getting a hit record out of it.
And that's the amazing thing, again, when you say it, you're right, it is. It's a lifetime ago, 5 years.
Yeah.
Right, which these days would be nothing. That sometimes would be the gap between releases
right.
with some of the artists, you know, or even longer. And just amazing how much they did evolve.
What a journey in those 5 years.
Thank you.
now it's time for Listener's Question. And this week in the studio with us, we've got our friend and executive producer
and in-house artist,
Rick Way.
A listener from Fort Lee, New Jersey, Mr. Richard Bader, writes,
Master Bader.
Did the William Shatner version of Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds become a hit?
Sort of a kitsch hit.
Yeah, a cult hit. Yeah, not a chart hit.
No.
I don't think any of Shatner's stuff did it?
No, but it got reissued through the years because it became sort of this thing that, you know, became cool after the fact. You know, there's all kinds of, there was that Rhino compilation, Golden Throats, where they got all the kitschy, ridiculous recordings of stuff. If I'm not mistaken, doesn't it have Sebastian Cabot doing Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds on there or something?
Yeah.
And I know he did Dylan stuff too, so.
Yeah. I mean, the thing with the Shatner stuff is, in line with his acting, it's so over the top and dramatic.
Oh, yes.
And hammy. And that's what's really got the cult following. Mm-hmm. I mean, Tom was telling us earlier that, you know, Shatner actually takes it seriously and thinks that his versions are the best because he's giving them his sort of thespian.
He's a trained actor.
Yeah, there you go.
He can give it.
Actor.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. The gravitas it deserves.
Yeah, exactly. So why don't we actually listen to a little bit of that?
I was afraid you were going to go there.
Picture yourself in a boat on a river with tangerine trees and marmalade skies. Somebody calls you. You answer quite slowly. A girl with kaleidoscope eyes. Cellophane flowers of yellow and green towering over your head. Look for the girl with a sun in her eyes. And she's gone!
Lucy in the sky with diamonds. Lucy in the sky with diamonds. Lucy in the sky with diamonds.
So there we go with William Shatner, the Shat, and his reading of Lucy in the Sky from the album, which I believe came out in 1968, The Transformed Man. Speaking of that year, to circle back to the Chris Barber thing and Catcall, now we have Paul 1 year later with the formation of Apple doing another similar instrumental production.
Thingamabob, yeah.
Yes, recorded with the Black Dyke Mills Band.
That's right.
Don't get excited. They actually were a band going back to the 1800s that were an actual band of mill workers.
Right, brass band.
Yes, a brass band. Yeah. And they were sort of the company band back in a century when there was such thing as company bands.
The Queen's favorite music, I'll let you know.
By that, you mean QE2.
I do, Queen Elizabeth II. Yeah, not sophisticated taste, our queen.
No.
Brass bands.
Which is perfect for Paul. You know, he's able to pull these melodies out of the air that adapt very well.
Pull them out of somewhere, yeah.
Pull them out of somewhere, yes. And he recorded them. What's interesting is that Thingamabob, it was a TV show theme, right?
Yes.
Yeah, in Britain. I don't know a thing about the show, do you?
I didn't watch it.
Okay, great. but this very high-profile release, it was one of Apple's first four.
Right.
And of course, you know, going back to the Queen, they sent the delivery of the first four Apple singles, which was, you know, this one, Mary Hopkin, Hey Jude, and Sour Milk Sea, over to Buckingham Palace.
Yeah.
You know,
Philippe, listen to this.
Right. So there again, there's photos of Paul at the session, you know, with Martha and his baton and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But it was Apple 1800, I believe, in the States.
Right.
So sort of an odd one-off thing.
But in the middle of an unbelievably hot period for Paul. For me, his halcyon period as a songwriter.
Right.
You know,
I mean, this summer he wrote Hey Jude and all that stuff for the White
Let's
Album.
Let's face it, if all the guy ever did was write Hey Jude and Lady Madonna, he'd be a legend.
Yes.
So, you know, he was on a real hot streak. And
he was.
As if it wasn't
his personal
enough,
life was disintegrating.
Yeah. And, you know, as if it wasn't enough for him to be turning out all this unbelievable material for the Beatles. He was now again giving away stuff.
Yes, he was.
Yeah.
And speaking of things he gave away that summer, there was the song he crafted for his old pal, Cilla Black, that
Absolutely,
summer.
Step Inside Love.
And which was her TV show.
Yes, correct.
Did you watch this show?
Yes.
And what was it? The chat show?
A variety show.
Okay.
A variety show. Ringo appeared on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And well, it was what? What was it called?
Oh, I can't remember. It's Scylla or something like that.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, okay.
But, you know, 68, and she's had shows ever since, by the way. You know, she's...
Yeah, she was like some game show host, right?
Marriage, one of those sort of dating game type shows. Yeah,
she's I know, hostess. Like, for a million years, she was on the tube.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
But in the late 60s and in the 70s, she had variety shows. And,
yeah, I think of her like sort of a Carol Burnett, only more of a singer.
Kind of.
Yeah,
kind
I mean, she did the comedy stuff.
Yeah, that's right, and she overplays the Liverpudlian accent. It's all like, ta-ra now, ta-ra, you know, and it's kind of...
People like this stuff?
Great.
But Paul did a demo for her, as we now know, because it came out on Anthology.
And we're going to hear that, and then we go straight into the Scylla Black version.
Right.
Step inside, love. Stand, stay. Step inside, love. Step inside, love. Look time up. Let me turn down the light. Come in out of the cold. Rest your head on my shoulder and kiss me goodnight. I'll always be here if you should need me. Night and day. Step inside, love, and stay. Step inside, love. Step inside, love. Step inside, love. I want you to stay.
So that was a big hit for Scylla in Britain, Step Inside Love. Was it in the States? Did it make any dent on the charts?
No, they buried her with You're My World, and that was pretty much the last gasp
in
America's charts of Scylla Black.
Yeah.
But now we're in 1968, and of course, John has long since stopped penning material for other people by this time.
Right.
George steps in with a song he wrote in India that they demoed at Esher when they were doing the Esher demos of White Album.
Sour Milk.
The Rishikesh stuff. Yeah, Sour Milk Sea.
Yeah.
And this was at the time Jackie Lomax had been recorded or been signed to Apple Publishing initially. They wanted him as a songwriter.
From Liverpool, being in The Undertakers.
The Undertakers, yes. Yeah. And they were the sort of peer group of the Beatles. They played the Liverpool circuit. They played the Hamburg circuit. And unlike the Beatles, and you can read about this in Fab Four Fact, the first book, where Jackie wrote the afterword and talks about his story and his proximity to the Beatles. I really miss the guy. I wish that we had had an opportunity to interview him before he passed away. Great guy to talk to. I don't know if you ever interviewed him in your life. But,
no.
He was living in Ojai at the time, California.
California, yeah.
And just very at peace with his role. He said, you know, being a satellite, you know, the way he put it, of the Beatles. And, you know, of course, in the summer of 68, he's there on the White Album singing the backups on Dear Prudence.
Right.
And anyway, so George hands him off the song that they've demoed that apparently either the Beatles considered and rejected, or maybe he had it in mind for Jackie all along as a song to launch him.
Well, the fact that it was, you know, in those Esher demos strongly suggests that it's one of the songs that George came back from India with as, you know,
as something for consideration for the White Album.
And as we know.
And maybe thought better of it because, you know, he was writing all this other material.
Or they may have been showing the usual offhanded attitude and they thought, screw it.
Yes.
Yeah.
So again, he plays the Clapton card and gets Eric to play on the track, recorded with Ringo and Paul.
Yeah.
It being a Harris song, of course, John has no involvement whatsoever. They bring in Nicky Hopkins and lay down this terrific, ferocious take of Sour Milk Sea. You know, Jackie at the Undertakers had been sort of this blue-eyed soul singer. Mm-hmm. You know, just he's got that real gritty R&B thing going on. And with a Harris song, you know, what could go wrong? Except Apple did not know how to promote their own acts.
Right.
You know, he should have been on the road. He should have been, you know, just getting all this exposure that way and not follow the Beatles textbook at that time of just putting out records and, you know, letting things happen. I sort of liken him to like an FM artist that was marketed as an AM artist.
Right.
And it just didn't find his audience.
That's right. So anyway, here is a bit of the Esher demo of Sour Milk Sea, followed by Jackie, Paul, George, and Ringo.
And Nicky. And Eric.
1, 2, 3, 4. If your life's not right, doesn't satisfy you. don't get the breaks like some of us do. Better work it out, find where you've gone wrong. Better do it soon, as you don't have. Shortest time, your dreams come true. In no time at all, makes you more aware. Very simple process, takes you there.
What's really great about that is, where else to that time do you ever hear in the same recording George Harrison and Eric Clapton trading solos?
Right. I saw it on stage at the Prince's Trust concert in 87.
Oh, you're talking about While My Guitar Gently Weeps.
Yeah, While My Guitar Gently Weeps.
No, because Jackie was performing that song
like
up until the day he died, practically,
right,
when he went back to Liverpool and stuff. So it's great. Look for it on YouTube, folks.
Yeah.
Anyway, Summer 68, among the first four. Who else do we have?
Mary Hopkin.
Yes.
Yeah.
Not a song written by Paul, song found by Paul.
Yes.
Gene Mann's Those Were the Days.
Yes.
Adapted from a Russian folk melody, apparently.
Yeah. You know, she was on a British talent show called Opportunity Knocks.
Yes.
Hosted by the inimitable Huey Green, a Canadian. And that was, like, show was extremely popular in Britain. And she won, like, I don't know, I'm going to sort of say 7 or 8 weeks running.
So it was sort of like an American Idol Star Search.
Oh, yeah, you come back every week. Well, yeah, it doesn't build up. It's not a knockout thing. Mm-hmm. It's just a knockout every week. That's
okay.
It. And if you win, you come back next week.
It's a knockout was a show.
That was a whole different thing.
Peter Gabriel. Anyway.
We digress.
We're so esoteric.
Yeah. So anyway, getting back to Opportunity Knocks, Yeah, so basically she was on there, and that really made her a household name in Britain because she just kept winning week after week.
And she'd actually recorded on a, I don't know if it was a local label, but she recorded some Welsh folk songs in 1968. Mm-hmm. And so she was definitely on the rise, getting a bit of notice. You know, these were successful for that niche market, such as it was.
Yeah.
But who was it that turned Paul onto her? Twiggy.
Aha, Leslie Hornby.
Yes. And so it was, I've read the interview with Mary Hopkin talking about being, you know, the 17-year-old at her home in Wales, getting Paul McCartney on the phone, asking her to come down to London for a session.
Right.
Yeah, and did not believing it was Paul McCartney.
Right.
And having to get her mother's permission and all that stuff. But, you know, he very much saw her as somebody he could market, you know, this Simon Cowell side of him, as I can make her a star. She's got the look, she's got the voice. It was not really the genre he was steering her to that she felt comfortable in. She saw herself as a very simple folky, and he saw her as this pop chanteuse that they could shove into pantomime and doing all that whole star trip. But anyway, those were the days. Big smash following up Hey Jude is, you know, this big single straight out of the box. From
that's
Apple.
Right. Apple gets off to a flying start.
Yeah, unbelievable.
Yeah.
And then that's 1968. The following year, he crafts a song for her.
Yeah.
And it was really sort of his last gasp of working with her. You know, he produced the Postcard album, of course.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then this was a song not on that album.
Goodbye.
Yes. So Mary had this hit with Goodbye, written by Paul. And we'll hear his demo now, which somehow didn't make it to Anthology 3.
Right, which is really surprising. I love his demo. Yeah. The only thing is, I don't know if it was intended that he's singing what ends up being the lead and the backing vocals, you know, the sort of call and response, goodbye, goodbye.
Yeah. Oh, he's sketching it all out.
Right.
Have you seen the promo film for that?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, he's in the studio, and you'd see him. It's like he knew he was on camera, so he's like waving his arms around.
Well, of
like
course. And all stuff. Yeah, typical. Yeah.
And they got the singers with the warts in there doing the background.
Yes. Yeah, but it's a terrific demo, so let's take a listen to that.
Please don't wake me up too late. Tomorrow comes and I will not be late. Late today when it becomes tomorrow, I will leave and go away. Goodbye, 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 my love, goodbye. Songs that lingered on my lips excite me now and linger on my mind. Leave your flowers at my door, I leave them for the one who waits behind. Goodbye, 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 my love, goodbye.
So that was Paul's demo of Goodbye. A little later, we're going to hear Mary Hopkins' hit version.
But speaking of demos, we're in the summer of 1969, the Abbey Road sessions. And now the backstory for Come and Get It, which we're going to talk about, is Ringo now has been filming since February of 69, The Magic Christian.
Right, with Peter Sellers.
With Peter Sellers, a Terry Southern novel. And
an all-star cast.
Yes.
Raquel Welsh.
Future Pythons.
Yep, that's right. And Yul Brynner. And Wilfred Hyde White. And
Attenborough, was he in there?
Yeah, Richard Attenborough. Yeah,
a whole,
yeah.
Lots of people.
Yeah.
And the QE2.
Absolutely.
Yes.
On the QE2.
Yes.
We won't go into that.
The nautical one.
Yeah.
Anyway, so Paul had been commissioned to do the score, to do the original material for that film.
Yeah.
Now, he's being pulled a million different directions in 1969. He gets as far as writing one song for the film, which fits the plot utterly. Come and Get It.
Yes.
Fooling His Money, if you want to.
That's right,
this.
Yeah, because if anyone hasn't seen that film, basically Peter Sellers is a multimillionaire who adopts this sort of waif, Ringo.
Yeah, Youngman Grand.
Yeah, that's right, and Guy Grand and Youngman Grand. And he sets out to show Ringo that people will basically do anything for the right price.
Yes, yeah, people can be bought. And so Paul writes an utterly fitting song for that. And I don't know what his intents were when he wrote that song as to who would record it, but come the summer of 69, there was an Apple signing from 1968 called the Ivies.
Yep.
And it was this band largely out of Liverpool, but also a couple of Welsh guys in the group. And they had put out a single, Maybe Tomorrow, penned by Tom Evans, who was the rhythm guitarist at the time, and didn't really do anything. You know, this was at the time, 69, Klein comes in, decides what's going to get released and what isn't. They record a full album, the Maybe Tomorrow album, and it doesn't get put out in the biggest market in the world, in America, due to Klein not thinking it's commercial enough. They sort of test market it. And anyway, come the summer of 69, they're kind of rotting on the vine. And Tom Evans gives an interview to Melody Maker, one of those trade papers, complaining of Apple's inattention. And Paul reads this, and he's like, okay, fine. I got it for you guys. We'll fix this. So he gives them the demo that he records during the Abbey Road sessions where he's multi-tracking all the instruments himself, the drums and piano and bass.
Incredible.
Singing. Yeah.
Incredible
vocals. He can just knock this stuff out.
Yeah.
And then he brings them into the studio, and what he does initially is he tries them out, like who can be the vocalist for this? Because he's got four vocalists in the Ivies, Ron Griffiths, Pete Ham, Mike Gibbons, the drummer, is even singing, and decides Tom Evans has got it. And they said later on, oh, yeah, sure, pick the Liverpool guy. and he had the perfect voice for it. So they end up recording it as the Ivies. It doesn't come out till late 69, early 70, by which time they've switched personnel. Ron Griffiths has been shoved out of the band. They bring in Joey Mullen from Liverpool, and it becomes Badfinger.
Yes.
They change the name. And during the initial promotion of Come and Get It as a single, they just have the three guys because Joey hadn't been slotted at that point.
Right.
And it becomes their, I think it went to number five or something.
Yeah, I mean, it was a big hit. And as Billy J. Kramer was saying earlier, he said that he was given the artistic freedom to interpret the song how he wanted. But,
the Ivies weren't.
But the fact is, everyone stuck close to the demos that, the Beatles gave them pretty much because.
Well, in this case, though, Paul was producing the session, said, I know it's a bit undignified, were his exact words, but I need you to follow this exactly because this is the hit sound.
Yeah.
Trust me.
Yeah.
And that was what he said to them. And they did. They sped it up a bit, and Mike Gibbons did better drum fills, but they largely stuck to it.
And let's face it, this is a time when chart-wise, the Beatles can do no wrong.
They can do no wrong.
So, who are you going to listen to? So
exactly.
But it is remarkable that, you got the McCartney sort of solo version, if you like, multi-instrumentalist.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you hear the Badfinger version, and it's pretty much identical.
Pretty much.
And they do it great credit, I think, and it was a deserved hit.
Yes, and in its way, it was, they felt, as they would, gear up the road or so, when George produces Day After Day, again, they get a good hit out of it, and this time it's original material, but they felt it was not really representing their sound.
Right.
And they didn't tend to do Come and Get It a lot on stage, mostly due to the fact that they didn't bring a piano with them, and unless the venue had one, that was their sort of quibble over it. And of course then they had their own hit in their own right with No Matter What, which really did represent them.
Yeah,
a song that Apple didn't even want to put out.
But isn't it remarkable, going back to, we were talking earlier about World Without Love and some of those real quality singles that were issued by other artists and sort of saying, it's amazing the Beatles didn't cover these. I mean, both Goodbye and Come and Get It, actually, because I'm not sure exactly when he wrote it, but they would have been absolutely perfect on the White Album.
Sure,
without
absolutely.
Doubt,
The White Album, such was its scope, there was so much unpretentious material on there, it absolutely would have worked.
Yep.
Something with the high production standards and it's sort of making a statement, even if it's not explicit, Abbey Road, I don't think it would have worked on that.
No. I think that Come and Get It, that kind of production would have worked. And I do think that Goodbye could have been almost like an acoustic, type sound.
Or a one-off single,
not
on an album.
Right. Right, absolutely. So it is, it's really surprising that those were given away.
If you want it, here it is. Come and get it. Mm-hmm. Making
but you better hurry, 'cause it may not last. Did I hear you say that there must be a catch? Will you walk away from a fool and his money? You better hurry, 'cause it's going fast. If you want it, here it is, come and get it. Make your mind up fast. If you want it anytime, I can give it, but you better hurry, 'cause it may not last.
As ever, it's been a pleasure.
Yes, thanks for listening, folks. Sometime we'll probably do another show on maybe post-Beatles giveaway songs.
Yeah.
As well as covers.
But for now, we're going to actually end appropriately with Goodbye by Mary Hopkin. So it's goodbye from me, Richard Buskin.
Goodbye from me, Robert Rodriguez.
And we'll see you next time.
Something About the Beatles, produced by Thomas Rapetney at Strad Studio, executive producer Rick Way.